Hello, listeners. This podcast is brought to you by The Morning Show, 88.1 FM WBGU, Bowling Green, Ohio. The Morning Show is your first source for local news and weather, community programming, commodity reports, and your exclusive source to hear in-depth interviews with Bowling Green High School and Bowling Green State University coaches. Your morning just got better with The Morning Show, 88.1 FM WBGU. For our listeners outside the Wood County area, you can still catch The Morning Show on TuneIn Radio or other similar streaming radio apps. And now, on to the show.
Welcome to the Wood County Prevention Coalition podcast, dedicated to bringing educational information to prevent substance abuse and help individuals achieve a healthy well-being.
Hello, my name is Tina Bradley, and I am the coordinator for the Wood County Drug-Free Communities Program here at Wood County Educational Service Center. I also coordinate the efforts of the Wood County Prevention Coalition. And we've gathered today to discuss the results of the Wood County 2024 Youth Survey data. So before we go in and do self-introductions, I would like to thank Greg Van Voorhis for setting up our equipment today. And we have with us too Shanna Gerken, and she is the Wood County Educational Service Center's parent mentor, but she's also the coalition's parent sector leader. So thank you to them. And if we could just do a really quick maybe self-introduction, folks.
Sure, I'm Angela Patchen. Prevention Program Manager here at the ESC.
Hi, I'm Kyle Clark, Prevention Education Director at the ESC.
Hi, and I'm Bill Ivoska, and I do research and evaluation for the ESC.
Welcome, everyone. Let's kick this off today with a quick discussion about the ATOD, the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Other Drugs section of this year's survey. So, Kyle and Angie, before we have Bill discuss the actual results, can you folks kind of talk to us about the history of this process, when it started, and then also the partners that are involved, because it's not just us going out into the community taking this survey to the community. There are partners that are specified.
Certainly. Thank you for that question. It's a good one, and it's one that we shouldn't forget within the county. But the Wood County Alcohol, Drug Addiction, and Mental Health Services Board, back in 2003, started the funding for our program with a small grant. And with that grant, we were able to go out and start a very basic one evidence-based program in the county within just a couple of schools. And at the end of that year, they asked us, what did you find out? What data do you have that shows us that this worked? And we quickly put together an evaluation tool so that in 2004, we had our first Wood County Adamus Youth Survey that was written and created by our team and Dr. Ivoska to find out if our programming worked. And after that first year, and our other schools saw the improvement that the few schools that implemented our program had received, they all jumped on board. And so we started offering prevention services in all the schools and continued work with our Adamus Youth Survey on an every other year basis. And this is our 20th year anniversary. It's fantastic. We've been around and we've been showing steady improvements in all areas. Without the funding opportunity that the Wood County Adamus Board generously gave us to start with, we wouldn't be where we are today. But the information gathered has just been overwhelming in terms of being able to use it to grow and make our programs better. So every few years we find enough new information that we say, hey, we should branch out in this area, or we should do something more with this program. And it's just been a wonderful tool to have, and so we continue using it. The other part of your question, I think, was?
Yes, our partners who we, and oh. Angie, I think you might get this question from a lot of people. You know, is it the parochial schools? Who is it that we're partnering with? You know, when they hear schools, maybe you can kind of expand.
Sure, it's the 9 school districts in the county plus Penta Career Center. As Kyle said, you know, the Adamus Board, Wood County Adamus Board, funds our survey. We're located here at the ESC. We also partner with the Prevention Coalition. I know you use the data for grant
yes.
writing and things like that. If I try to name all the partners, I'm sure going to miss somebody.
Yes.
But we partner with, you know, a lot of community agencies, you know, the health department, with the mental health, CRC, and some of the other mental health providers and things. Just the data is available to everyone to use and to compare, as we other folks do surveys as well, like the health department. There's just lots of opportunity for partnering.
Dr. Voska, can you discuss the process that was used to conduct the survey? I know it was a little different this year.
Sure, thanks, Tina. Well, even to piggyback on what Kyle had said, in 2003, that very first program that we did was life skills, I believe. And we gave it to a variety of different classes in different schools. And Kyle was just coming in, and they wanted to know that those kids who took life skills differ from those kids who didn't take life skills. And you can't do that today, because you really can't deny a treatment effect to some people and give a treatment effect to others. But because we could only give it to a few, we were able to compare. And we didn't have any technology back then besides paper and pencil. So we created a survey on one hand, and an answer key on another hand. And so students originally, we had to read a question and then go and bubble in their answer, read a question, bubble in their answer. When we created the Adamus Drug Survey, the Youth Drug Survey, it was a 4-page booklet, and students had to go back and forth like that. Greg Van Boris packaged all these up for us, and 10,000 surveys in hundreds and hundreds of envelopes went to all the schools, into all the classrooms. Kids took all this paper and pencil, put it all back in, shipped it back to the office, brought it back home. We had to go through them all and then scan them into a computer, download the data into a statistical package for me to evaluate. Very time consuming. That was how we started. But now COVID hit, and the educational process for just regular faculty had to go online. And heretofore, kids didn't really have laptops and iPads, but COVID gave them laptops and iPads because they needed it. So when we came back to do the survey this year, we decided, let's drop all that paper pencil, let's let Greg have a break of putting all that in envelopes, and give all of the hard efforts into the closet, and let's just do an online survey, which we did. Now kids can just bubble their answer and hit it right away, and we found that survey time went from about 30, 40 minutes to 15, because kids could get at it much more easily online than they did paper pencil.
Well, I know too, Kyle, there's some other advantages, I think, dollar and cent wise, and even internally here with the staff usage.
As Bill alluded to, the office time of doing the paper pencil was astronomical. Shifting to the virtual format and online format gave us a little bit of savings, and it also gave us quicker turnaround time statistically for Bill to do his analysis, and a quicker turnaround time obviously for us to get it back out to the community and to the schools. So you know, pre-COVID we just did not have the opportunity. We discussed it, we were getting ourselves prepared for it, but we just didn't have the opportunity to do so because not all kids had access in schools yet. And as Bill said, with COVID and some of the COVID relief money that came in and helping schools have online education, kids now have the opportunity to get online in all of the schools virtually at the same time and take the survey. And as Bill said, it's just saved all kinds of time. It saves class time, saves our time. It's just a good benefit all the way around.
Seems to make good sense. Dr. Voska, now we get to come to the part that I'm sure you're excited to tell us about, the alcohol, tobacco, and other drugs section of the survey. Any gains, any new concerns? What happened this time?
Well, first of all, we've been looking at things like alcohol, marijuana, benzodiazepine, painkillers, methylphenidate, inhalants, LSD, all those different drugs for 20 years. And 20 years ago, there was some semblance of all of these. Alcohol was very prevalent, marijuana was very prevalent, and even some of the other more illicit drugs had a presence in Wood County. But for 20 years, things have been declining steadily. A little bit of a rockiness, bumpiness, but generally they've been going down. And then at the time of COVID, kids all went home for a year and a half. And the very first time they were back, we had our survey conducted, and there was a sharp decline. It had been declining for 18 years, but now there was a sharp decline into, I think, the 20th, 22nd year, not only in Wood County, but nationally. And it was really surprising what had caused that big decline. And a lot of the researchers attributed it to the fact that kids were at home and they failed to initiate drug use. Because they were home, they didn't take any drugs. They didn't have access to them. They were under supervision. They didn't have all the influence of their peers. And there was a sharp decline. So this year, it was after kids were back in school for 2 years. And we were wondering what would have happened to that sharp decline. Would it continue to go down? Would it level out, or would it bounce back up kind of to where it was earlier? And that was our research question that we were looking at when we gave the survey out.
So we've got these great results that kind of have come about. It sounds like we made some strides in terms of lessening the number of youth that were using alcohol, tobacco, other drugs. Any concerns that came out?
Well, yes. The good news was that the decline that we talked about, and it was a sharp decline during COVID, the 2 years after COVID, when kids were back in school, that decline that was sharp continued to drop. It didn't level out, and it didn't bounce back up. So we were thrilled to see that, because that meant that drug rates were the lowest they've ever been in 20 years. Remarkably lower. And what that means for kids is that when you fail to initiate and then you use less, that decline will probably persist with you the rest of your life. Because kids who use less as teenagers tend to use less as adults. And so that's a great thing for a prevention team to be able to push out into the community, is less drug-using teenagers. So one of the exciting parts for us, too, is vaping. We know vaping had really escalated pre-COVID, and then after COVID, it dropped, and we were wondering where was that going to be. And that was nice to see. That also continued to have a sharp decline, and maybe some of the honeymoon period of vaping is over. Schools are getting a handle on how to handle it. Juul went out of business. There's a lot tighter controls on it now, less access. So we think that pandemic of vaping might be over as well. So good news to see the rates drop as much as they have been.
Certainly good news. So Kyle and Angie, what's the relevance to prevention education? How do these results inform the practices that will be taken here?
Well, we can use these kinds of trends, like Bill mentioned, you know, when we see something coming out of nowhere or when it's rising, we can use that to decide what kind of programming we need, you know, to recommend to the schools, and even down to grade levels. You know, we can look at a graph that Bill presents and say, oh, look at this eighth grade class. You know, they seem to be using more of this or starting to initiate vaping and stuff. So that means we probably need to start with the seventh graders. You know, not that we don't need to talk to those eighth graders too, but that helps us to know which grades and ages to target a little bit of our prevention programming to get ahead of. And I think that's a hard thing to do with our society. We tend to be reactive, and so getting prevention is all about getting ahead of a program and knowing what's new, and then again finding the relevant evidence-based practices too that are able to meet you know, the needs that we have and what we see as problems.
That's exactly what we use it for, and as Angie said, as you're saying, we can pinpoint grade levels around the county that may need us to jump in that following year and follow them and really go after that piece that looks like it's increasing. And we can even drill down to school districts and provide different things for their districts where they're showing a spike. But beyond that, and Bill and I have had and Angie, we've sat around and had discussion of this too. This was COVID created an opportunity for us, if there is a good thing that came out of it. I'm not sure this is even good, but it's like a social experiment. We're able, as researchers, as programmers, we're able now to say, what's going to happen 2 years down the road? Now that kids were socially isolated from each other and from school activities, now, and we saw the trend go down, so there was less initiation time. Now that we're back in school, and we're back in school, you know, by the next survey cycle, it'll be 2026, once kids are back into those social activities and they're on track again with having fun with their friends, activities they go to, sporting events that they go to, school activities, more parental family activities, will we start to see that social peer pressure stuff hit the kids again and make them increase a little bit in what they're doing? Or will our education and prevention programs kind of hold the line now since that? And that's a question we don't have the answer to yet, but that's one that we're going to be watching.
Certainly, and we'll know more in 2026 in that regard.
Yeah, and I actually have a hint for you already because I've been plowing through this data. And remember I mentioned that those kids who were, say, a ninth grader pre-COVID are just today's senior. So because he didn't initiate, his rates are now lower. But kids who were back in fourth, fifth, sixth grade, it wasn't their initiation time anyway during COVID. So some of them missed all of that part. And what I did notice in further research on this is that some of the increases, although minor, are with fifth, sixth, and seventh graders. Uh-oh, because they missed that whole experiment that you just talked about. Right. We might see the drug rates coming back up again unless we can, and some of our program might need to be at those earlier elementary, middle school grades.
Are there any final thoughts in relation to the survey results as they surround substance use before we move on to the mental health results of the survey?
Well, I guess I would say we're cautiously optimistic. We're excited about the results we saw in the survey, but as you just heard, we need to really dive into this data deeper and obviously look at more programming that might hit the youth that are just initiating, just getting ready for that initiation.
And I don't want to say it's all good news, while we have also know that the fatality rate of kids using drugs, believe it or not, nationally is higher now than it had been before. But that doesn't make sense. I just said drugs went down. So if you take these two things together, what it really means is that while kids might be using drugs at a lower rate, what they do use is far more dangerous. We have fentanyl, we have other very toxic chemicals that can be introduced to the drug. If you take a pill, it may be what you think it is, it may be a counterfeit. And so kids have got that message. So it is dangerous, and I think that's why you're seeing some of the decline too. But we don't want to say this is all good news, because there's certainly some ugly things that are still around.
And there are social conditions that impact it too, as you mentioned earlier, with things like Juul, you know, the trouble that they got into and the impact on their business. And now we have marijuana, you know, adult recreational use that's now legalized, and so that will have an impact, or could have an impact,
right,
on the youth as well.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And specifically, as what Bill just said, the you know, 10 years ago, we never heard of fentanyl or heroin being laced with marijuana. Now we are. So that you know, the big three, nicotine, alcohol, and marijuana, kids are really hearing the message that marijuana is being laced with some dangerous stuff, and it's not what they thought it was in terms of safety.
Before we get into the results of the mental health segment of the survey, Angie, can you talk to folks and convey to them what we mean by what are we serving, what categories, what are we speaking about, and the relevance it might have to substance use when it's related to mental health?
Sure. Well, initially they added the problem severity scale, which is one of the problem scales from the Ohio scales that the Ohio Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services had used with mental health agencies for a while. And so they were looking at the number of problems and severity of problems that youth reported at home and, you know, interpersonally. And then over the years, we've added suicide ideations and suicide attempts within the last 12 months. A couple years ago, we added the ACEs questions, the Adverse Childhood Experiences questions, which is 10 questions about family dysfunction and abuse and neglect. And then just, I think, two or three surveys ago, we added the hopelessness question. So we're looking at reporting hopelessness, or it's kind of a depression screener, like within the last 2 weeks. So those are kind of the things that we've begun to add because we know we can't show causation, but we can show correlation between mental health and substance use, whether folks are using substances because of the mental health or they're using substances and that is increasing mental health difficulties. We're not sure, but we know that they're related.
So it's a good thing to survey and kind of get a sense. Yeah, definitely. Dr. Voska, before we get into the nuts and bolts, the actual results, can you talk to us historically what we've seen in terms of the results related to mental health prior to this survey?
Sure. Well, as Angie pointed out, when we added the problem severity scale, 10, 15 years ago, it's 20 questions, but it can be divided into five categories at the end. Kids that show no problems, minor problems, up to severe and intense problems, five categories. And what Dr. Donnelly from the CRC wanted to know was the kids who are admitted to the CRC, Children's Resource Center, usually have severe and intense problems. He wanted to know what the general population would look like. And unfortunately, he found that there were lots of kids in the community that had severe and intense problems that were not getting professional care. And that was a concern for him as well. So we started tracking, are those intense and severe problems going up? Are they going down? Are the kids with no mental health problems going up or going down? And what we were finding is that kids seem to be showing a healthier mental health status. Kids with no problems were going up. Kids with intense and severe problems were going down. Suicide ideation had been somewhat going down for a while. Bullying, kind of related, not necessarily to mental health, but it strongly can affect, was kind of going down. We had bullying prevention programs in the schools, and things were looking good for a while. But then pre-COVID, things again started to change. We started to see an increase in mental health problems, an increase in suicide ideation and attempts, and an increase in bullying, and now we weren't sure what's going to happen when kids went home and they were with their family, and when they came back to school, and what would happen with all of that after 2 years of post-COVID.
So what did we see in 2024?
Well, while COVID was good for a decline in drug use, it didn't really help everyone in their mental health. Kids showed a sharp increase in severe and intense problems returning from COVID. They didn't seem to be enjoying that time at home. We had seen one of the highest rates of suicide ideation and attempts during that COVID period and right after. So the mental health wasn't looking favorable for us. And we hear a lot on the media about the mental health crisis in America. We know it's occurring for adults. Has that trickled down, and is it existing within kids as well? So when we got our results, we were really happy to see that the number of kids who reported severe and intense problem dropped 3%, and the kids who were reporting no problems went up 3%. So we finally maybe crested the top of the hill and are coming back to a better place. We saw suicide ideation drop and attempts drop as well. And even the ACEs for childhood abuse and or neglect were better. Kids were feeling a little more loved, I suppose, at home than they had been around the COVID period and the like. So it seems as though mental health was getting to be a better thing, and we were glad to see all of that.
So, Angie, how does this instruct us in terms of how we move forward in the schools with prevention education?
Sure. As I said earlier, you know, we try to use the data to make decisions about programming, and we got a little bit of help from the Department of Education this year in that they passed some legislation requiring schools to provide suicide prevention, violence prevention, and social inclusion, which should hopefully help with bullying, to all 6th through 12th graders. And then they also required schools to implement sexual abuse prevention and dating violence prevention programming. That's known as Aaron's Law, and that's required for kindergarten through 6th grade. And then 7th through 12th, it's during health class. So it's not every year, but at least during health classes. So again, we would try to use the data anyway, and then I think that even though we've had some declines, we still, you know, mm-hmm. the numbers are still concerning when you have 20% of kids thinking about suicide within the past year. You know, that's quite a lot. It's still more yes. than we'd like to have. So by implementing some of these programs that we've identified, we're hoping that we can help to reduce that. Get them connected with services.
Right. Well, the rates are better, like I said, and Angie's pointing out, they're nowhere near as good as they once were. So we have a long way to go to get them way back to where they were 15 years ago.
So any final thoughts before we shift into the next category of the survey results? Any final thoughts related to mental health in the survey?
Well, we didn't talk about bullying, but a little bit. Bullying did go up. It's been trending upwards, and in particular, it's in grades 5 through 9. Kids tend to bully less when they get to be juniors and seniors, but those middle school years are tough times, and bullying seems to be trending up. We haven't been giving bullying education for a while, and maybe the neglect on that is starting to show itself. So that's one of the troublesome things, because like Angie said, does that cause mental health, or does mental health cause you to get bullied? I'm not sure, but bullying's trending up a little bit.
And then statewide, along with some of the more specific laws that Angie already highlighted, there is our schools, right before COVID hit, were introduced to an encouraged program by the state called PBIS, Positive Behavior Intervention and Support, and they came out with some new Ohio Department of Education standards in social emotional learning. All of the programming we provide here at the office to schools are supportive of both those programs, but only to the audiences we actually reach within the schools, because we're not in every grade and reach every student. But the schools themselves are required to do these programs. And so their curriculums and their programs that they have to provide locally to meet all of those standards, those are all starting to kick in now that we're back from COVID. And we think that that's been a big help to the whole general wellness of our youth. So that's a positive.
It's a good thing. Definitely, definitely. We're going to shift now to the category of gaming and gambling as it relates to the survey. And Kyle, can you give us a sense, when we talk about gaming and gambling, what are we talking about in terms of what we're asking the youth that are completing the survey?
Well, obviously, this is broken down into these two categories. Gambling being actual bets or wagers that you put on something, whatever it might be. And that's usually been confined in the past to adults 21 years of age and older. And then there's the other issue of all of the video games that kids are have exposure to now, and what they have evolved into. And so gaming, as Bill will probably talk about, and I'm going to let him maybe discuss this and define it a little better than I can, but gaming is the amount of time your kids are spending with gadgets in their hands, any kind of an online tool. But within these games, there are opportunities for kids to take chances that will get them to another level or get them a tool to get somewhere. And that has us concerned, because now we've developed, I guess, a local term called gambling. It's gambling within a game. And I'm going to stop there and let Dr. Ivoska go. Mm-hmm.
Well, Tina, this all started when the racinos and casinos came into Ohio. They gave us the money for prevention, about 2015, something like that. So when we first started looking at gambling, we were wondering, what are kids even doing? Are they shooting hoops in the backyard, placing bets on each other? Are they betting on their favorite sports team? And then kids would have a football pool for pros, a fantasy sports team. That was what gambling was like. But now it's evolved so much more. Now you have FanDuel and DraftKings came onto TV, and you could gain what's called a daily fantasy betting, daily fantasy sports, where you can bet within a game. Will that pitcher make the pitch, or will that golfer sink that putt? And you can be playing that way. And now it's even onto your phone and onto your laptop. You can be playing actively while something's happening. So what started pretty benignly is getting very, very intense. And we've been trying to track gambling. And some gambling's okay, but we also wanted to look at disordered gambling, pathological gambling. Do you get to the point where you're so consumed by it that you are registering into the Diagnostical and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders classifications that you're a problem gambler as a kid? We want to track that as well. So what we found is that gambling amongst males is going up. Sports gambling in particular is going up. FanDuel, DraftKings, things like that. Daily fantasy sports are going up. And something even, we can start moving into gaming, because Bowling Green State University has what's called eSports. It's a gaming sports team that's intercollegiate, and you can get a scholarship to it. It's an intercollegiate sports team. You can bet on that. So we have eSports betting. We have to start monitoring this as well. Those young men are betting more on eSports as well. They're trying to download these apps onto their phone, and if that doesn't work, they're asking somebody 21 years of older or age of older to place a bet for them. So we're seeing gambling, and we're seeing disordered gambling going up. That's a bad thing. Okay. Gaming, then, is another thing. Gaming has evolved as a technology for younger kids. You see third graders, fourth graders, fifth graders spending hours playing Fortnite and Roblox. And within that game, which can be healthy, it can be good. You can be playing with your friends. It can be a social community. And by the way, these kids all initiated gaming during COVID, because there wasn't anything else to do. And now that COVID is over, they haven't stopped gaming. They're gaming a lot more. In fact, we asked them, how often do you game 2 hours or more every single day? How often do you game 2 hours every single day? This is not talking about piano lessons or violin lessons or homework. This is gaming every single day. We also asked them, how about just once a week or once a month? 50%, 40 and 50% of fifth and sixth graders game 2 hours every single day. So the activity is very prevalent. Then we wanted to look at, how about disordered gaming? Is that pathological, and is it getting to be a distraction? That's still a little bit low. But again, let's evolve this whole conversation some more. While you're gaming, as Kyle pointed out, the makers of the games have created them in such a way that you have to have weapons or skins or cloaks of invisibility or something to help you defeat your opponent. And you can get these tools by going to the tool store and buying them, earning coins and buying them, or by taking grandma and grandpa or mom and dad's credit card, putting some money into it and then buying them, or you could earn them. Or the third way you could get them is by taking a chance on a treasure chest or a mystery box. They call them loot boxes. You're on your way throughout the game, and there pops up this mystery box. I could take some of that money and place a bet on that box, and when I open it, lo and behold, I could get a weapon, or I could get nothing. And what we're finding is that there's a huge increase in kids betting on those boxes. And that activity is occurring. Now let's go back to what I always like to talk about. Is that pathological? Well, that rate has gone from about 3 and 4% to 6 and 8% over the past 2 years. Kids are showing those signs as kids in the gaming world, just as adults show at the casino world about the pathology of being distracted or having problems with emotional regulation, problems with impulse control, and the like. So we're tracking that, and we're not seeing good things here. Drugs are coming down, but they're being replaced by a whole new vice, gaming and gambling, within their home environment and the school. And not, I shouldn't say the school, it's probably more their home environment.
So we haven't always asked questions related to gaming and gambling historically, have we? Has that been something
we
new?
We started asking the question, I think, back in 2018, I think is when we first introduced it.
We first introduced it, but it's hard to keep up with them because it's changing so much. Now we have gambling legalized in Ohio, and it hasn't even really started yet, but in bars, in casino, in Kroger. Kroger just applied for a license that you can have sports betting at the checkout. You know, you see lottery machines there now when you walk out of Kroger. You can buy your scratch-off cards or whatever. You're going to see a sports betting kiosk within the next few years.
And of course, the concern we have, maybe not so much with the machines you were just talking about, but certainly with lottery machines. Most of the time, those machines are placed in such a open public area, like across from the checkout and to the aisle, the outer wall of the store, that no one's really monitoring that. So I could be under age 21 buying tickets, and no one's really checking on me. So we don't know yet what that effect will be on these new machines, but we're anticipating that placement will be very close to the exit of the store and probably not much monitoring. So that's a concern.
Angie, how does all of this impact how we move forward in schools with prevention education?
This one's a little more difficult because, you know, as I mentioned, all the other programming that we're already doing, and then all of the things that schools still have to teach, you know, English and math and science and all the other things. So time is difficult. To get more time in classrooms to teach about these things can be hard. So an initial step that we've taken over the last few years is to integrate the language about risky behaviors and talk about gambling in and around while we're talking about drugs and alcohol and all those other things. So just we're kind of adding in gambling to our traditional programming. And looking at ways to increase intentional teaching. But again, to ask schools to give us another 4 or 5 or 6 or 10 sessions is a big ask.
Certainly.
To take, you know, to not take away from other programs that, or teaching that they have to do. But Bill mentioned emotion regulation earlier, and so and Kyle mentioned social emotional programming and learning. So those are places that we can, again, just try to teach kids basic skills that help them resist drugs and alcohol, resist turning to addictive behaviors of any kind, whether it's the behavioral kind or substances. So, you know, we can look at teaching basic skills that they need, emotion regulation, anger management, mindfulness, you know, some of those kinds of things to help kids. Those can even help you calm down when you're taking a test, you know, or when you're playing sports. So those are just life skills that are necessary and needed. Mm-hmm. And so that's a way of, we can also help with behavior in the classroom and outside.
And generally, I guess I would say schools are very supportive of prevention work that we do, but they do have a delicate balance between environmental factors that we are basically talking about and academic standards and academic achievement. And the balance comes in of being able to try to assist our schools with common objectives that they're teaching and using some of our curriculums as the heart of the lesson, but still accomplishing their objectives. And then that helps us get into classrooms and helps us to expand what we're doing. Because schools understand that all of these environmental factors, alcohol, tobacco, other drugs, gambling, gaming, mental health issues, all of these things are taking away the concentration that kids have in their academic learning in the classroom. So if we can eliminate or minimize any of those environmental factors, we're going to see more focus on academic time by the students in the classroom, and hopefully that leads to higher academic achievement. And that's the ultimate goal that we all have as preventionists and as educators.
Any final thoughts related to anything, gaming and gambling, or really anything in any of our other segments related to the survey?
I just reaffirm what Angie had said. If we can help improve the mental health of kids, that'll transfer into almost everything. Because what we've been able to prove with our data is that, for example, being bullied isn't necessarily makes you go drink or go decide to game for hours in seclusion. It really, it's mediated in the middle between the two is your mental health. You could be bullied and process that in such a way that you handle it well because you're resilient and you had the good programming, you were able to calm yourself back down and then not be adversely affected by it. So we really want to work on that mental health aspect through all the programming, and Angie and her team does a great job with that.
Thank you all for your contributions to this process and today with our interview here. And everyone stay tuned. I'm sure there'll be another round of survey results in 2026, as well as possibly even a panel that will discuss results. Thank you for tuning in.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tina.
This podcast is intended for educational purposes only. Those views expressed on the podcast do not necessarily reflect the views of the Wood County Educational Service Center or the Wood County Prevention Coalition.